Imagine the Pope, dressed in his white robes and wearing his half-moon glasses, hunched over a laptop, blogging. Probably not going to happen, although Benedict XVI does have a Facebook page. But in a recent message, he called on priests to proclaim the gospel through blogs, videos, and websites. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
The call to blog took a lot of people by surprise. After all, the 82-year-old Pope from Bavaria is better known for his conservative doctrine and revival of the Latin Mass than for his computer savvy. At first, Father James Martin was startled as well. He's author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and blogs each day for the Catholic magazine America. But then Martin thought, surely Jesus would blog if he were on the earth today. He didn't sit at home and wait for people to come to him.
He went out and he met people, you know, by the Sea of Galilee who were fishing. He went into tax collectors' booths. He went into synagogues. He went all over the place. And so we need to, sort of figuratively speaking, go out to the ends of the earth, which includes, right now, the blogosphere.
Now, the Pope has not announced his own blog. But if he does, he might be wise to listen to the experts.
As a blogger, let me just say I have some advice for His Holiness. The first being, now, if I link to you, you must link back to me.
There are rules of reciprocation, says Elizabeth Scalia. Scalia, no relation to the justice, writes a blog called The Anchoress, which appears on the website of the Catholic magazine First Things. She adds, the Pope should aim high.
He should try to get linked by the bigger blogs. He should try to be linked by, for example, Instapundit and the Huffington Post. Because if he gets the exposure there, then he can up his blog ad rates.
Presumably, ad revenue is not high on the Pope's list, although there are a few bankrupt dioceses in the United States that could use some money. Scalia says while blogging is not heavy lifting, the Pope should prepare himself for the unrelenting pressure to post.
You have to blog every day, and he's an 80-something-year-old guy, so maybe he's not always going to want to blog. So he should have some videos, some favorite YouTube videos that he can just slap up there when he's feeling kind of tired, you know, like the parade scene from Ferris Bueller. Slap that up there, and that's a day's blogging.
Of course, a blogging pope would also have to adjust to the style of the Internet. Benedict is a German theologian famous for his long academic treatises peppered with footnotes. How to adapt?
Think hot links and not footnotes.
Father Jim Martin.
He can, if he wants to, he can write a couple paragraphs on, say, St. Augustine or Origen or St. Athanasius, and instead of having, you know, 50 footnotes, have 50 hot links, and people tend to like that on the blogosphere.
Martin has another piece of advice. Be charitable. The Internet can be vicious, but he must refrain from ad hominem attacks. So, should the Pope allow comments?
Only if he has a thick skin. I would say there's two kinds of angry people. There's angry people, and then there's religiously angry people. And the religiously angry people tend to be angrier than the angry people.
Still, David Weinberger sees some dangers ahead. Weinberger writes about politics and culture on his Joho the blog. He says if the Pope wants to spread the Christian message, he might be surprised at the result.
Putting a message out over the Internet is exactly the same thing as losing total control of your message. People take it up, they republish it, they make fun of it, they contextualize it. The simple message becomes incredibly complex.
Which raises the question, can something as nuanced as God's word be tweeted?
Trying to boil things down into tweetable form has a long history.
Weinberger cites a theologian of his own tradition, Moses, and his Ten Commandments. Don't murder, don't lie, don't steal, etc. They easily fit into Twitter's 140-character limit. And what about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, that'll require a hyperlink. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Obama will be talking jobs, jobs, jobs tonight during his State of the Union address. Getting the unemployment rate down is key to the economy's recovery. So is fixing the housing problem. After all, the housing collapse was at the root of the financial meltdown. In December, sales of existing homes suffered their worst drop in 40 years. Still, overall sales for 2009 were up compared to the year before, thanks in large part to the first-time homebuyers credit. Well, should the government be doing more to help the housing industry? For answers, we've called on William Wheaton. He's a professor of economics and urban studies and planning at the MIT Center for Real Estate. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And do you think the president is doing enough to fix the housing market?
Well, unfortunately, there's not a lot that actually can be done. Many of the foreclosures that we have going on right now are really due to job losses. Unfortunately, the best way to fix that is to fix the economy.
Can't the government do something in terms of mitigating the rate of foreclosures? It does have several federal programs aimed at doing that, although by many estimations not too successful.
Well, I think that's the problem. Almost every proposal to help fix the situation has a severe drawback. Mortgage lenders don't really like to fix mortgages because they find that a large fraction of mortgages fix themselves. And they also find that once they fix a mortgage, there's a fairly high probability of redefaulting. So you're just going to have to really strong-arm them if you want to get anything done there. And another proposal is that the government should simply provide some cash assistance to pay people's mortgages who are temporarily unemployed. That has the disadvantage of creating an incentive not to go back to work. So it's really not easy to fix this.
So there isn't a way, you don't think, for the government to shape a response by the mortgage industry to say, we are going to take a whole bunch of these mortgages that are underwater, which means that people owe more than the house is worth, and rewrite them and write down the principal?
I actually don't think that very many of these mortgages that are technically underwater are going to default. There's several recent research reports that suggest that people have to have a great deal of negative equity, 30, 40, 50%, before there's even a small probability that they're actually going to walk from the house that they were trying to build a life in and default. I know there's a lot of press that suggests there's a wave of 5, 10, 15 million people who are underwater who could default. We think virtually none of those people are going to default.
That's interesting, because many of them have defaulted already.
The data actually shows that the very vast majority of people that have defaulted because they can't afford the payment, because they've lost their job, something's happened to their family situation, as opposed to people who can afford the payment but technically are underwater. Their house is worth 20% or 15% less than their mortgage.
What is going to happen when the first-time homebuyer's credit expires at the end of April and interest rates might go up?
Interest rates might go up considerably, and I think that's something that really worries the Fed chairman greatly. I'm guessing that most of the people that are in negative equity territory at this point are probably on fixed-rate mortgages. So I'm a little more concerned about what rising rates would do to the new buyers of homes that have actually all of a sudden come out of the woodwork and are purchasing homes like crazy. I think they could be greatly dissuaded if mortgage rates rise from 5 to 6 to 7 to 8%. And I think both Treasury and the Fed are working very hard to try and minimize the effect of rising interest rates on mortgage rates.
Will you be looking for anything tonight from President Obama regarding housing?
I hope he can pull some little magic trick out of his sleeve to help the people that are unemployed at least stay in their house for some extra 12 months or 18 months to see if they can get back on their feet. That's always a problem during recessions, and that would make me very happy.
We've been talking about real estate and the housing market with William Wheaton. He's a professor of economics and urban studies and planning at the MIT Center for Real Estate. Thank you very much.
Delighted to have been here.
Earlier this hour, we heard about the launch of Apple's new product, the iPad. Among many functions, it's a device for buying and reading books. And the publishing industry is hoping the iPad will do for books what the iPod did for music. But author Eric Weiner is worried about the growing popularity of the ebook, and not necessarily for reasons you might expect.
The other day I was in a cafe when I noticed a woman reading a Kindle, Amazon's clunky, oddly quaint e-reader. "Do you like it?" I asked. "Yes," she said, beaming. "It's great. I can travel with 200 books, a library at my fingertips." Being an insecure author, is there any other kind, I asked if my book happened to be among those lucky 200. She punched a few keys in her Kindle, and up popped my book. Well, not my book exactly, but the same words that appear in my book. There's a difference. The printed word has a permanence, a finality to it that digital ink lacks. Digital words are provisional, always subject to change. Call me Ishmael. No, call me Brad. Yes, that's much better. Much of the talk about ebooks has focused either on technical issues or questions of pricing, but that misses the point. The technology will improve, especially now that Apple is in the game, and I'm confident that I'll still get my fair share from each ebook sold. But as an author, I'm not after your money. Well, not only your money. I have my sights on a much more precious commodity. Your time. We enter into an unspoken pact, you and I. Give me a few hours, stolen moments on the subway or after the kids are asleep, and I promise to inform and entertain you. Frankly, that's always been a tough sell, given the sundry ways you can spend your time. But at least I had a fighting chance. Curled up with a Pinot Noir in my book, your attention was mine to lose. Not anymore. The new generation of e-books will, in essence, merge the laptop and the book. Now, if my narrative starts to drag or I digress, readers can click onto their favorite news site to see what's up with healthcare or click onto TMZ to see what's up with Brangelina. How do I compete with that? I realize that, no, you can't stop progress, and yes, I suppose I could take the I don't care how they read me as long as they read me approach, but that would be naive. Technologies are not neutral. They come with a bias, not a political bias, a narrative bias. A news story broadcast on television, an acutely visual medium, is different from the same story published in a newspaper or broadcast on radio. Form is function. Someone reading a book on their Kindle has a fundamentally different experience from someone reading the same book the old-fashioned way. The fact is that books are special. Why else are we so careful not to bend their spines? Why else do we grant them honored space in our living rooms, our bedrooms? I can't see people expressing the same reverence for the flashing bits of data that flicker across their e-reader. And don't even get me started on what this means for book signings. Yes, it's wonderful to have a library at our fingertips, but the digital library is a noisy, crowded place filled with sports stars and politicians and celebrities. I'm afraid you might not even notice that I'm there, too.
Eric Weiner is the author of The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. He's also a former NPR reporter, and you can comment on his essay at the opinion section at npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.